Okay, good morning. You are the last people left standing, right? I can tell you at the beginning of the semester which of these lectures will have the lowest attendance rate, and it's this one. And I'll tell you where it's going to peak again as we get closer to the final exam. But you are the good folks. You're here, you're sticking with it, so good for you. If you can make it to section tonight and tomorrow, that's great too. What are we doing today? Well, last time we left off talking about opera in the 19th century, and the session before that, we were talking about the development of the piano in the 19th century. Today, what do we want to do? We're going to talk about the development of the symphony, specifically the symphony orchestra in the course of the 19th century. And it did undergo significant changes, as we will see. What symphonies have we visited here in our course? Who can give me the name of a symphony that we have studied? Roger? Beethoven's Fifth Symphony, we did a lot with that at the very beginning of the class. Any other symphony? Elizabeth? Beethoven's Sixth, which was the basis of the Saybrook concert. Any other symphonies? Angela? Beethoven's Ninth. Yes, we talked about that in an early lecture. So we've done a lot of Beethoven. And Thaddeus? The Surprise Symphony, good. The Surprise Symphony of Joseph Haydn. So we've done some Haydn. Anything else? We haven't mentioned somebody I thought you might mention. Mozart. Okay, Mozart's G minor symphony. So we've done Mozart, Haydn, and Beethoven for the most part. But there's a lot of symphonic composition after these individuals. Extends into the early 20th century, and that's what we're going to track today. So today's lecture will generally be about the symphony from one M to the other M. You hear about the three B's in music? Well, these are the two M's, from Mozart to Gustav Mahler. Let's start with Mozart. Let's play just a little bit of his Eine kleine Nachtmusik, a little night music. It's a sort of divertimento, evening music for entertainment. Let's listen to a little bit about it, and then I'll say something. What can we say about that music? Well, we've talked a lot about this before. It's very patterned, it's very symmetrical, it's balanced. We have antecedent and consequent phrases, and they come into music with the classical period. What about the orchestra? Well, it's rather small in that it's dominated principally by the strings, and we had a couple of listening exercises where we'd see the strings play the themes, and then the woodwinds maybe come back to echo them or to answer them. But most of the musical material is getting presented by the strings. The texture. Well, the texture is rather thin here because it's not a very big orchestra, a thin texture. And what can we say also about the texture? Well, it tends to be rather polyphonic, homophonic, or monophonic. Well, in that case, homophonic. Basically, you got a melody plus accompaniment. And we could also say, something we've talked about, that this music has a kind of rhetorical strategy to it. We have this idea of music that sounds like a melody, sounds like a theme, or music that sounds like it's coming between themes, it's leading us somewhere, transitional music, music that may be a contrasting theme, music that ends a section. So it's music that does something, music that's trying to get us from point A to point B and point C and so on. So it's a sort of rhetorical music, teleological music, if you will. Okay. Now, let's turn to a piece of romantic music. And before we do that, I'm going to say a thing or two about this romantic music. It's a piece by Tchaikovsky from his Romeo and Juliet, and I think we have the titles of the pieces that we'll be listening to on the board up there today. So from his Romeo and Juliet. And you've probably heard this music before because a lot of it used to be used in cartoon music. You know, anytime there's a love scene, this particular music music would come on. So what are its qualities here? Well, first of all, it has a long sweeping melody here in romantic music, long sweeping melody that is rather asymmetrical in shape. Instead of having neat units of 2 plus 2 plus 2, it could go on over bars, or maybe it'll be a 7-bar phrase, something like that. So the melodies tend to be long, they tend to be asymmetrical. Rhythm. Think about rhythm in the music that we've been listening to. My paradigm here is the beginning of the Brandenburg Fifth Concerto Grosso, in which the rhythm starts out it's very regular. It's like a machine gun almost, or a sewing machine, or some kind of repetitive process there. When we get into the classical period, rhythm is somewhat more relaxed, but it is still a pattern. Dum di dim da 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 dum bum ba bum ba 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 bum. But here with this music in the romantic period, the themes are not only long and asymmetrical, the rhythms don't seem to shake out in patterns that allow us to tap our feet or allow us to conduct it easily. So we have ties over bars, we have lots of syncopation, we have irregular phrasing, somewhat irregular metrical patterns as well. Tempo. We've talked a little bit about this before, and this idea of tempo rubato. Here in romantic music, we get wild swings of tempo in that they can be coming along at a regular pace and then slow way, way down, and then speed up to get back on track and slow down and so on. And this is part and parcel of the romantic aesthetic in the sense that it tends to swing wildly from one extreme to another, wildly in terms of rhythm and wildly in terms of dynamics. We can go from very, very quiet to very, very loud in a way that Mozart couldn't. Remember, we were talking about Mozart's piano, which weighed about 1/10 of what this piano weighs up here. This piano probably weighs about 800 pounds. Mozart's probably weighed about 100 pounds. So this is a much bigger instrument. You can play very quietly on it, or you can make a huge sound on it. Same thing with the orchestra. And we'll come back to that point today. Mozart had a modest orchestra. Mahler at the end of this period had a huge orchestra. So this allows for these wild swings. The romantic period is sort of a bipolar period, I guess, in terms of music in that regard. Okay, having said that, let's listen to what we might call a prototypical moment in romantic music out of Tchaikovsky's overture to Romeo and Juliet. Starts to build a little bit of melodic sequence working up here. Reaching higher and higher each time. It out there. So it's a really remarkable passage. It's made possible by this newly enlarged orchestra. So let's talk about this orchestra for a moment. And we're going to reference here our four food types or our four instrumental groups for classical art music, starting with the strings. We don't really have any new instruments here in the Romantic period. We still have basically the four string instruments of violin, viola, cello, and double bass. But they are different. They're different from the instrument that Mozart was playing. What happened? Well, in the 19th century, the construction of the violin was changed rather significantly. And I think I could just sort of hold my hand out here, maybe demonstrate this kind of thing. First of all, there was a higher bridge put on it. If you have the bridge holding up the strings in an 18th century violin, it might be like that. 19th century violin like that, higher bridge. That allows you to have more tension. It puts more tension on the entire instrument, and at the same time, the strings that had been used, which were made of, anybody have a sense of what violin strings in the 18th century were made of? Chelsea? Catgut sometimes, yes? Yes, animal lovers, catgut. More normally, sheep gut, okay? So sheep gut, the tension that could be put on that was not as great as if you were using a wire string. So in the 19th century, technological advances, wire strings, more tension, higher bridge. Also the fingerboard was extended. It's longer. So oftentimes the Stradivarius, they chop off the fingerboard and put a new fingerboard on it and put it all back together again. What else? I know I'm missing one other important thing. March. Well, maybe that will have to do it for the moment. And what will we end up? Oh, I know, the bow. The bow, if you look at an 18th century bow, and go to our collection of historical musical instruments on Hill House Avenue, the amount of horsehair there is rather narrow. It's almost double when you get to the 19th century bow. So the bow is bigger. So the whole thing is more powerful. And I've asked Jacob just to bring in his viola, which is fundamentally a 19th century viola in construction, and just rip through a couple of things just to give you a sense of the volume of the instrument. Playing it. Okay, so that's all I wanted him to do, but just to give you a sense, that's a big, rich sound. Can you play a couple of chords, just maybe the ending of something with double and triple stops to much volume? Okay, so big, powerful 19th century violin as opposed to the smaller one that Mozart had. Let's talk about the woodwinds. Here in this family, new instruments were introduced. First of all, we have the piccolo up at the top. We've heard the piccolo before. Remember in the storm scene of the Pastoral Symphony, number 6 of Beethoven, storm scene? If you wanted to get a sense of the whistling wind up there, and that's what he did, he had the piccolo play way, way up high, and you could hear it. It kind of gave that effect. At the other end of the extreme, we have the double, the contra, or double bassoon being added, the low bassoon, playing down an octave lower than, is that correct, Linda, playing down an octave or even lower than that? Okay. It's enormous. And actually, I think the bassoon, the contrabassoon, plays lower than any instrument in the orchestra. Is that correct? In terms of actual frequency. So it's adding to both the high and the low range of the woodwind family. And a new instrument was introduced. Actually, it had been around in certain quarters. A new instrument called the English horn. And I think we have that up there on our list of terms. Is the English horn from England? And is it a horn? No. It's actually from France and Germany. And it's a woodwind instrument. It's not a brass instrument at all. It's kind of a low or tenor oboe. So it's a kind of oboe in a tenor range, but it has a beautiful, rich quality to it, and a somewhat nostalgic quality. Arguably the most famous English horn passage is the one that you're about to hear, which comes from the slow movement of Dvorak's New World Symphony, which, as you might suspect, was written here in the United States, actually in Spillville, Iowa, in New York City and in Spillville, Iowa. So here's a little bit of the English horn solo out of the New World Symphony. Okay, we'll stop it there. It's lovely, lovely, lovely. It's funny about music, what it can do for you. My mother's family were actually from Iowa, farm family from Iowa. And as a child, they took me to Spillville, Iowa, get in the car, we're going to get culture this afternoon. No more softball games, we're going for culture. So we went to Spillville, and I can't hear that music without thinking of that particular family or those particular people in Iowa. It's weird, it's kind of a, as we've said before, music is kind of an entry to the inner recesses of your memory sometimes. In any event, aside from that discursus, let us continue now with the brass family. What were the two instruments in the orchestra that we have encountered up to this point in terms of brass instruments? What have we heard in a symphony? Elizabeth?
The trumpet and the
trombone. The trumpet and the trombone. Okay, fair enough. Trumpet and trombone. There's one other important one that actually was in the orchestra before the trombone. Chris? The French horn. And in point of fact, the trumpet and French horn were kind of in there first. Then Beethoven, with the Fifth Symphony, brings in the trombone. But it's not until the 19th century that the trombone gets added to the orchestra. Where does Beethoven do so? Well, he does it in the finale of his Fifth Symphony, when he wants this particularly powerful brass sound. So let's listen to the opening of the finale of the Fifth Symphony, where the trombones are brought into the orchestra for the first time for this particular effect. So that's how Beethoven gets this kind of heroic effect. He's doing three things here in the finale. One, switching from minor to major. He has a very triadic theme, and he's bringing in the heavy artillery, the newly invented heavy artillery, or at least newly introduced heavy artillery of the trombone there. And it gives it this powerful, if you will, in the vernacular, sort of ballsy effect with that brass. And this got extended to the low brass as well. The one family of the brasses that we've talked about that we haven't really explained in terms of the history of the orchestra is the tuba here. When does the tuba get introduced? Well, it gets introduced right about this time, about 1825, 1830 or so. The first composer to use the tuba in an orchestral piece was Hector Berlioz in this Symphonie Fantastique that we're going to be embracing in sections this week. So we have the tuba coming in here, and actually it was, as you can see there, originally an instrument called the ophicleide. It was a French instrument. And Berlioz heard this as a kind of giant keyed bugle in the military bands of the period. Think of the French Revolution, think of the Napoleonic Wars, all of these troops marching up and down with the brass bands along the Champs-Élysées. He hears this, he brings this military instrument into the symphonic orchestra to add depth to the lower part of the brasses. Let's go back to our Dvorak piece here, the Dvorak New World Symphony, second movement, and here we can hear the power and the depth of the newly enlarged brass section. Tuba and so on. So that's something of the brass group as an ensemble. Let's think of these instruments individually. If we look back at a symphony by Mozart, not only is the orchestra stronger, but how he's using these brass instruments is very different. We looked at the French horn before, and we're now going to focus on the French horn. In the very beginning of our course, we had a professional French hornist in here, Ava Heater, and she played. Does anybody remember anything of interest about the instrument that she played and how it differed from the modern French horn? What didn't that instrument have that the modern French horn has? Roger. Keys, okay, keys or vowels, yeah. That's it exactly, keys or vowels. That gets put on the instrument. Instead of sliding in these crooks and exchanging the length of pipe that way, they figured out a way of having vowels and you could do it quickly and with keys. But that's a 19th century invention. 18th century horn just kind of overblew and it could play some things such as da 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 dum very easily, repeated pitches, da 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 ba bum. Remember our horn concerto of Mozart, or ba-bum, bum, bum, it could overblow up the harmonic frequencies, up the partials, as we said before, with ease. But it couldn't play chromatic kinds of things, and as a result, it's kind of stuck there in the background, kind of providing what I like to think of as a sonic glue for the orchestra. But it rarely plays any solos in the orchestral fabric outside of a concerto. Well, let's see what happens to the French horn inside of the orchestra here in the 19th century, where it begins to come forth as a solo instrument because the melody it can play is so much more complex and much more interesting. So here's a famous French horn lick out of Brahms' First Symphony. Back to the horns. Listen to the depth. Okay, we're going to stop it there. So it's a lovely passage, but it's featuring the brasses and particularly the solo French horn. I guess the thing also to notice here is how slow the music is going, slowly the music is doing. It's kind of all slowed down, kind of going at a crawl here. And that's an interesting point about the whole 19th century notion of time and what they thought about time and the passage of time. You know, in the early 19th century, beginning of the discovery of the whole discipline of paleontology and how old the earth was and how many years civilization had existed and so on. And it's all getting extended. Instead of biblically 5,000 to 7,000 years, now it's 25 million years, which of course has been greatly extended since then. But everything here is being allowed to slow down. And by way of reference, let's go back to our Mozart here and think about how he constructed it. There we have, again, the beginning of Eine kleine Nachtmusik, and he has a chordal pattern, triadic, going up. That pattern lasts about 4 seconds. If you bum, two, three, four, come down, one, two, three, four. 4 seconds on each chord. He's moving through his material rather quickly, and we'll say why in a moment. Now, by way of contrast, let's go to music, 60 or so later, years or so later, in the middle of the 19th century, and focus on an overture by Wagner here, Overture to the Flying Dutchman. And we're going to listen to just the end of this and sort of think about how long Wagner can sit on each chord. Mozart thought he could sit on each chord here for about 4 seconds. How long does Wagner sit on a chord? All one chord, change, another chord, all one chord, just triadic notes of that one chord, changes that to minor, just drops the third down, same chord, and now back to the original chord, holding that one chord. There. 9:52. So we had 52 seconds of music there, and we went through three chords. So we're averaging about 18 seconds per chord, something like that, 4 or 5 times more than Mozart was doing. How can Wagner do that? How can Wagner do that? What's the difference? Why did Mozart have to move through his chords faster? What's happening in this music? Supposing you tried to play that Wagner music with Mozart's orchestra. It wouldn't work. It wouldn't work. Mozart had this dinky little orchestra. How many people were in Mozart's orchestra? Well, it depends on where he was at a given time. Haydn's first orchestra had 16 people in it. Mozart, when he gave a concert in Vienna, usually wanted about 30 to 33. We get to Beethoven, we're up to 50 to 60 in a typical Beethovenian orchestra in Vienna, 1810 or so. As we move into the later part of the century, these orchestras keep adding more and more instruments, more and more players. You got to balance, well, if you're going to have all this brass, you got to balance them with more string players. So we're getting up to 80, 90, 100 by the end of the 19th century. So this is an important point. Mozart had a very small orchestra, and as a result, or maybe he could get away with what he had because he had great musical ideas, right? He had to have great musical ideas because the sound itself wasn't going to rescue him. With Wagner and these later composers, they may not always have to have the greatest of musical ideas. The triad is not a particularly novel musical idea, but he can get away with just taking he can get away with doing that, and it sounds great. I mean, everybody, didn't we like that Wagner there? Didn't that sound terrific? That's just because he's got this huge orchestra. Sound per se is replacing musical idea. Mozart, terrific ideas. Wagner, terrific orchestra, and he knew how to use it. So, bigger orchestra allows longer movements. I have said it before, I think that it's axiomatic in music. The more people you have on a stage or involved in a performance, the longer that performance is going to take. And with regard to the symphony, how long does a movement within a Mozart symphony take? If you were to look at the CDs up here of a Mozart symphony, what would you guess? First movement of Mozart's G minor symphony, how long does that go? Yeah, who said that? I can't. Okay, Oscar says 7 minutes. Yeah, and actually that's about right for the G minor symphony. It ends at one of the shorter ones of Mozart, but we'll say 5 to 10 minutes, 10 minutes outside. If we get to Beethoven, how long will a movement of Beethoven take? Well, about 20 minutes, sometimes, with his bigger symphonies like 3, 5, and 9. When we get to Mahler and Bruckner, the length of the movements can go on even more. And an entire symphony of Mahler might go on for an hour and a half. So these are bigger. The big orchestra has led to longer symphonies. And the sound, obviously, is very luxuriant, very opulent. Sound in music probably never gets any more opulent than it does here at the end of the 19th century. Two other aspects involved here, having to do with the physical world and, in a way, technology. Of course, the 19th century is the period of the Industrial Revolution, and some of these innovations in terms of metallurgy and design got applied to musical instruments. For example, how many have ever played the flute in here? Okay, a number of people, both male and female. And if you looked and remember the video we saw of a Baroque flute, it actually had very rudimentary keypad on it. And you look at a modern flute and it's got this keyed system with all these things up there, all of the different keys and extenders. And that's all an invention of the 19th century. They completely reconfigured the flute and how you play it in the 19th century. And we've talked about all these other instruments that got added. So a kind of technological revolution was applied to musical instruments too. But the most interesting thing is when you got all these instruments together, how much sound they could make. Let's say you were in the 19th, you lived in the 19th century, and you wanted to hear the biggest sound that could be made. What do you think you would do? Where would you hear the loudest sound? Jennifer? An organ. Okay, that's good. That's pretty good. Though it wouldn't have sounded as loud then as it does now, because now we're using something else I'll get to. But that's a good start, okay? Anything else? Doesn't have to be musical. What would give the biggest sound? Sarah? I beg your pardon? Acoustics in music halls, yeah, we're going to come to that, but just in the real world. You're in the city of London. What's going to annoy you the most, make the biggest sound? Roger? Possibly a bell, yeah, but that's back, we've had those since the Middle Ages. I was thinking of two things, cannons, okay, huge firepower there, huge loud sound, deafening roar. And one other thing that came in the 19th century, steam engines and all the things that it could produce, trains, steam whistles, this kind of thing. But the third thing really is this orchestra, when all of these new instruments are coming together in such large numbers. And once you have them all together, you got to have a place to put them. So they started building new concert halls, and concert halls are particularly good acoustically. The model for this, and I don't know if I put this, yes, we did, okay, it's up there on the board. It's in Vienna, it's called the Musikverein. And it's a famous hall, and it's a remarkable hall, maybe the most perfect musical hall ever built. That was the prototype. And then other concert hall builders around the world began to adopt it. We adopted it here in the United States. Anybody think of a concert hall in the United States that is particularly famous and acoustically beautiful outside of Carnegie Hall that I'll talk about in a moment? What other one? There's one other one, early concert hall in the United States. Symphony Hall in Boston. If you're ever in Boston, anybody from Massachusetts here? Anybody been to Symphony Hall? Okay, go in there. It's a knockoff of the Musikverein. So if you want to see what Vienna looks like, go to Symphony Hall in Boston. There's another one that is very close to us here, that's pretty close to this design. And where is that? Built about the same time. Our own Woolsey Hall, a big hall seating about 2,500 people. If you're ever in Woolsey, notice the fundamentally rectangular design on it. Go in and look at the floor. It has a suspended floor there. And it has a suspended floor for a particular reason. That floor serves as a resonator. And there are other resonators around that we needn't go into. But next time you're in Woolsey, go in and bounce, because that's on that floor. It's designed to have the sound resonate more. Now, what's the problem with Woolsey? Why don't string quartets like playing in Woolsey? It's too boomy, okay? It's too resonant. But what was the model? The model is, you get, Roger, Well, it was partly built for the organ. Yes, it was built for the organ. But Woolsey Hall can sound absolutely marvelous for a symphony orchestra, not booming and not overly resonant, if what happens? Robert, if it's full of people, because people absorb sound. So all of the boominess, the long reverberation cycle, gets sucked out of it into our bodies as sound absorbers, and it produces this absolutely spectacular symphonic sound. So that was the model, and that's another the great. And I was struck the other day when I went to Nashville, they've done a knockoff of the Musikverein in Nashville in that Schirmerhorn Symphony Hall down there too. It's brazen, but you know, just take that design from Vienna and put it right there in the middle of Nashville. Pretty interesting. Okay, so that's another thing we have to kind of keep track of. Carnegie Hall is a little bit different in terms of its design. All right, now let's take a look at what I call the main line here of symphonic composers. And it's mostly a German tradition, right? A German symphonic tradition. But that became the model for the United States, and that's why they brought Dvorak here. Tchaikovsky came to the United States and was involved in the opening of Carnegie Hall in New York City in 1893. As you can see, running from Mozart down to Gustav Mahler. Not all of them were German. Who up there is not German? Roger? Tchaikovsky was from where? Russia. Who else is not German? Oscar? I beg your pardon? Berlioz? Oh, yes. Oh, I'm sorry. Of course, Berlioz. He's, of course, French. And we'll talk about him in section tonight. Anybody else? Well, Dvorak, he's Czech. Okay. So, but they are all in this fundamentally German-educated tradition extending really from Bach. But he didn't write symphonies, into Mozart, Haydn, Beethoven, down to Mahler. So we're going to go to the end of the line now and talk a little bit about Gustav Mahler. Any of you listened to, ever heard a symphony of Mahler? If you've heard any music of Mahler, raise your hand. Okay, I would say about a third of our class has. Let's talk about that just for a moment. I would say that if you haven't been introduced to Mahler, don't miss this one. It's really great stuff, and I hope to be able to convince you of that here today. If you're kind enough to come along with us here in this trip along the road of high art music, and we don't want to miss the pinnacle, in a way, of high art music. For me, these two M's are very important, Mozart and Mahler. They write some really astonishing music in different kinds of ways. So Gustav Mahler, who was he? Well, he was a Jew, born in Moravia, which is a section of Czechoslovakia, got his musical education in Vienna, was a pianist and principally a conductor. He earned his living conducting, and he went all around the world conducting, and we'll talk more about that next time, where he conducted. And he composed mostly in the summertime. He would go out to the Alps in one of these mountain retreats where he had have solitude, and he would compose. And in the course of time, he wrote principally 9 symphonies and something we're going to talk about next time, which is the orchestral song. But we're focusing on just one symphony today, indeed his first symphony, 1888. It starts in an unusual way with a kind of homage to Beethoven, because the beginning of this Mahler's first symphony sounds like the beginning of Beethoven's 9th symphony. But let's just listen to a bit of it. Oftentimes with Mahler, people talk about the cosmic quality of Mahler's music. Well, what does that mean? What kind of sound is cosmic? Well, maybe it's kind of open, maybe it's kind of hollow, maybe it seems to be endlessly spacey in that way. So here's a good example of Mahler's style, particularly his cosmic style. Okay, just stop it there. And those trumpets were sort of offstage trumpets, perhaps giving you more a sense of a far out distance. So that's the beginning of the first movement. And I've put this diagram up here because it's interesting that so much of the material that he is working with derives from a particular complex, a particular cell of material. Mahler is a developer, and that's generally speaking what this German mainline tradition is into. Not always. Tchaikovsky is not a developer. He has trouble when it comes to developing themes. But Mozart's a developer, Beethoven is a developer, Brahms is a developer, Mahler is a developer. And what they develop is, a nexus of musical material. So this here is the initial idea. And we can go back to our technique. Ya, tim, pom, bim, pom, bim. And it would go back down to the pom, pom, which would loop back to the tonic. So we could have one more X down here, but it's the same X as up there. All right, so that's the essential motive of the first movement. Let's go on to hear just a little bit of the second movement, which is a delightful scherzo here of the First Symphony of Mahler, just the scherzo. All right, just enough of that. And now we're going to go on to a very strange movement, the third movement, the slow movement. Remember, in symphonies, we usually have fast, slow, scherzo, fast, finale. Well, in the late 18th, early 19th century, sometimes they'd switch those. They put the scherzo number two, and then the scherzo minuet number two, and then the slow movement number three. So here we got the slow movement as number three. Let's listen to a bit of it. See if you can recognize the melody that Mahler's working with here. Okay, I'm going to pause it here. I saw a smile come over Jacob's face out there. Jacob? Right? Frère Jacques, or in German, Bruder Martin, Brother Martin, Frère Jacques. But what happened to Brother Martin or Frère Jacques here? He got zapped into the minor, okay? So this is a kind of gloomy Frère Jacques. It's a weird a movement in a way. It's taking the familiar and making it weirdly unfamiliar. So that's what happens here in the slow third movement. Now, we're going to pass on to the fourth movement, because that's the big ticket item for today, this morning, and I think we have time to cover it. It's going to start out with this gigantic kind of opening fireworks of just pure orchestral sound, an introduction, and then a couple of themes will crop out. Dim pom pom, bam pom pom, and then a little bit later, dim pom 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 pom, bam pom da da dum pom. So we have these two themes here that we'll be working with, and we'll pick up some other themes a little bit later on. So let's hear and all get ready for a big explosion here, the beginning of the finale. We'll be right back. we're going to phase that out. So that's the first theme material there. And you have the using the same kind of Xing process that we began our course with. We can make use of it here to kind of track or remember these particular themes. Myself, I can't always hear them, but if I can visualize them, it helps me. All right, so we're going to now go on to the second theme area. He's essentially following our sonata allegro form here. And we have a long passage. It goes on for about 3 minutes, but it's a quintessential moment of romantic music. It's along the same lines of the Tchaikovsky that we heard before. So let's just start out here, and we'll listen and we'll comment on what's romantic about the music that we're hearing. End of transition. Here comes the theme. Let's just pause it here for a second. What's romantic about that? Thoughts, Elizabeth?
There's a lot of slurred notes.
Okay, yeah, it's a lot of slurred notes. Whether that it kind of inspires us to romance, I'm not really sure, but it's not precise. It's not marching along, it's not discrete frequencies. Now, what instrument is carrying the melody here? It's particularly good at that kind of what's the German word in Vienna? Schlaggruber or something like that for whipped cream kind of sound. Probably some German, native Germans in here can tell me. Elizabeth, what instrument is playing that? The violins. And this is because the violins have this capacity for vibrato and to slide between pitches, it gives this kind of romantic effect. So it's not marching along in any kind of precise way here. All right, so that's my principal point, a warm, lush string sound. Let's go on. Okay, so we jumped ahead to the next, rather than pausing. No, that's my problem. Well, I tell you what, that's okay. We're getting close to the end of things anyway. We really have only about 2 minutes left, and I do want to, everybody was good enough to show up on time, so I'm going to let you leave on time. Let's go, just to give you a sense of the sound here, let's go to the very end of this. So let's go to, if you would please, around 1630. It's a long movement, it's about 20 minutes long, we got about 2-3 minutes to go. And you're going to hear this extreme orchestral contrast here as it gets bigger and bigger. Notice that we had a minor theme here, the same theme comes back, but he takes out all of the chromatic minor sound and makes it all major, and we're going to get lots of heroic trumpets going up with that addition to our theme. Think about this. This I'd like to think of as the last gasp of the traditional high art classical orchestra. It never got any better than this. It never got any bigger than this. For reasons that we'll maybe comment on after. So let's listen and then one comment at the end.
Thank you.
one final thought. Why did it stop here? What happened in the history of art music to change everything? Anybody have any idea? Daniel? Exactly. That's what happened. Electronically produced sound, where you could control the decibel level and reproduce it. People started staying home and playing recordings, and they could manipulate the volume any way they wanted at that particular point. Okay, thanks for staying on. Have a great break. I hope to see you at sections tonight and Friday and Monday when you get back.